You're listening to an Alalon Netcast, the Roxburgh Journal, Episode 3. I'm Bill Kennan. Today's episode is a little different from the previous two. In this Roxburgh Journal, Alan is interviewed by Toronto pastor Daryl Dash. The interview took place just before the Resonate Echo Alalon Missional Leadership event in Toronto that Daryl and I had the pleasure of putting together. Audio from that event is available as a separate two-part Alalon Netcast. As well as being a pastor, Daryl is actively involved with Resonate, a network of missionally minded Christians seeking to live out the gospel across Canada. Check them out at resonate.ca. Daryl is a well-known blogger, engaged in the missional emergent conversation from his perspective as a pastor of a Baptist church. He's also a columnist with the Canadian publication Christian Week. This interview forms the basis for one of Daryl's columns, which you can read on Daryl's blog at dashhouse.com. Alan and Daryl continued the conversation of missional church in a traditional church context that Alan had in his previous two netcasts with Steve Taylor and Mike Goheen. Daryl begins his questions with a particular Canadian focus. Alan's answer speaks to the Canadian reality, but is applicable to much of the Western world.
What are you discovering as you travel, and especially in Canada, as you talk to churches as they deal with, the end of Christendom, and I don't think they know what to call it yet, but whatever period that we're entering right now.
I have to begin by saying what I'm discovering is really to a large extent outside of Canada. Much of my work is across the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Australia and New Zealand. So they're the larger context in which I work. In terms of Canada, I'm in conversations with lots of people that I can make some very broad stroke pieces, and I want to be careful about that. I'm finding that the conversation about the end of Christendom, that's sort of a conversation everybody knows. The fact that Canadian culture is changing pretty rapidly, that's known and understood. I think where the issues start to arise around the questions of, so what does it mean to be the church in this new context? And then I think there's a lot of diffuse answers to that question in Canada. I find that amongst sort of the broad evangelical community, which you can't just kind of lump into one group, there are some very creative people who are beginning to think outside the box, both theologically and in terms of practice. How do you do ministry? There are those who have learned a lot from what we would call the postmodern turn, who are seeking to engage the questions of what is the gospel in this new culture. At the same time, I see a lot of what we would call denominational systems and the leaders of those denominational systems understanding that there needs to be change, but more often than I think I would like to see, what I'm observing is that they are taking new language like emergent and missional without really thinking or appreciating some of the deeper impacts that this means, and simply using this language to rehabilitate a sort of a program-oriented or pragmatic-oriented sort of way of engaging the church. In other words, without understanding the deeper culture change that our churches need to go through, there are attempts to revitalize churches in that way. So that's part of what's going on. There is, like in the US, like in the UK, like in so many other places, there's a whole movement now I hear across Canada in church planting. And while you want to laud that and recognize that we constantly need to be planting churches, my other sense is that so much of that church planting comes out of an anxiety about existing churches and almost a fear that you can't change them. So we've got to plant these new churches in order to do something different. And again, as I think church planting is important, I don't think that people are asking these deeper questions about, in a changed context, how do we look ourselves in the mirror and ask what it means to be a church in these contexts? So I think there's a lot of pragmatism going on, a lot of searching after programs, but not a lot of reflecting or reading oneself. I don't want to lump everybody in that. I see numbers of younger leaders in lots of experiments across Canada, and I think that's wonderful. My hope is that those experiments can find life one and two generations on, and not just sort of moments of testing. But I think overall, you've got a church, an evangelical church certainly, that is in massive flux, that recognizing the story that shaped it for much of the 20th century is not a story that it can, that's going to move it forward, and is seeking and searching in multiple ways. And I think that's a healthy thing, and it's going to go on for a while.
You use this term discontinuous change.
Yes.
Could you unpack that a little bit?
Continuous change, let me start there, is, to use a different word, it's change within a paradigm. I might drive a Plymouth for 5 years and shift over to a Ford for another 5 years, or we might be a church that is run off a certain kind of seeker-sensitive program, and then we seek to become a church that is run off a more emergent program. These are continuous images of continuous change, or the standard example I give of continuous change that all of us can recognize is that we are always changing. You in your 40s and I in my early 60s, I'm not the same person I was in my 20s or my 30s or my 40s. I've been changing, but it's been a continuous change, not a radically disruptive change. So continuous change is going on all the time. So there's nothing new about change. Discontinuous change is where there is a massive disruptive shift. So in human relationships, a discontinuous change is divorce. Or perhaps to use a better example, a couple after 5 years have a child. It's discontinuous change. It changes the way you relate to each other and the rhythms and the times. So what I'm trying to get at is that sometime in the last quarter of the 20th century, the culture in which we live, which we call North America, went through radical change, which means that the habits, the practices, the way we've lived, the way we've done church was developed for a certain kind of culture. When that culture shifts, those habits and practices no longer make sense in that new world. A simple biblical illustration is that in Egypt, God's people, Israel, learned how to manage change. And for, 200 odd years, they learned how to manage being slaves in Egypt. And the way they managed that is they became very good brick makers and very good bread makers. And so they were very good at what they did, and they knew how to thrive in that environment. And then when God called them out of Egypt and they go into the desert, now that's discontinuous change. And the question becomes, if you're a very good brick maker, what do you do in the desert? And you have to learn a whole new set of skills. So likewise, what I'm saying is that in Canada, the culture has gone through such rapid change and continues to go through rapid change that the maps that we've used to be the church no longer describe the reality where we find ourselves.
Forget which book it was, but I think you mentioned that this discontinuous change we're going through is likely going to last another at least two or three generations.
What I was saying was, I don't think it's going to end in my lifetime. I don't think it's going to end in your lifetime. I think we are in the midst of something which is going to go on for quite a while. So the expectation that this is a blip and things will settle back down, I don't think that would be a helpful thing. Now, behind that expectation are several things. One is anxiety. It would be like parents. You know, you have this gorgeous kid who suddenly at 15 or 16, you go, is that our child? Massive shift. When that happens, and as a parent I can say this, there's this deep sense inside of it won't last long and we'll be back to where we were before. And then what happens is you begin to go, no, we're not going back to where we were before. And that raises a massive level of anxiety because now you have to renegotiate the whole relationship. And so what I'm trying to say is that if the expectation is, you know, these changes are short-lived and things will settle down, that is, I think, a myth that will not help us understand the negotiations we're going to have to make in a whole new culture.
So let me give you, I think, a realistic picture of a congregation that probably exists all over the place. So used to be higher attendance at the church.
Yep.
There's still a good group of people hanging on. They still see some results, but they see diminishing effectiveness.
Right.
And they're there. They recognize things aren't going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, they've sort of grabbed at different programs, thinking if they do this, it'll help if they do that. Now that they're at the point where nothing's really had a lasting impact, and they're together as a church, sort of wondering, what do we do now?
Yeah, yeah.
So what would you say to a group like that?
Well, okay, you're asking me a question that there's a long answer to that question. So let me try to not give you a long answer, but at least give you some context for that. I experience lots of churches like that. And what they do is what some people call become attractional. And what they do is to ask, okay, how do we take what we're doing and make it better? How do we improve upon what we're doing? With the hope that if you become welcoming enough or have the right programs or the right youth programs or the right childcare, you will attract people. So that's going on a lot. And the assumption behind that is that the culture inside this church doesn't really need to change. We've just got to get better at what we're marketing, right? And that gets done in all kinds of ways. Introduce a program, get a different pastor, all things like that. But most of the, quote, solutions that people are looking for are what I describe coming from outside. So a denomination will call in a great leader from somewhere. If it's Canada, usually the States. And this leader is going to come in with the answer to turn it around. And they usually come in with a program that they've picked up from somewhere else. So by and large, the imagination that's going on inside that church is that hope and, quote, salvation for us is somewhere outside of us. New pastor, new denominational exec, new programs. That is the cultural imagination that has to be, to use postmodern language, deconstructed. So long as that cultural imagination, that way of thinking, exists, there will never be innovation or transformation or creativity. What you will get are short-term spikes. So, for example, and I've seen this, a new pastor will come in with great ideas, or a denominational exec will come in with a new way of being, and everybody will get energized and they'll start working at it. The sad thing is that those things last so long as those leaders are around. Why? Because it never really gets at the deeper cultural issues. So all of that is a way of saying, if you're going to innovate what I would call a missional life in the kind of church that you're describing, then you've got to think not at this surface level about programs and ways that work elsewhere. You've got to think more deeply about the culture issues, the environment that's present. Having said that, then here's what I want to say. I think the biggest transformation that's taken on in my life in the last 15 years is to realize that amongst those people that are making up that congregation are all the answers to the question that you're asking. And that the role of leadership is to create the environments in which the Spirit of God can work. Now, having said that, what do I mean? What I mean is that, well, let me describe my experience. My experience in the kind of church that you're describing is that people are playing games. And the games that they're playing is, this is what we believe. And we've got to keep telling people what we believe and saying what we believe. And the pastor, he or she tends to be either preaching propositions and doctrines to make sure or help us keep believing these things, or preaching and teaching what I call kind of the help gospel. You know, here are the three ways that you can get out of this passage to help you this week. Here's how you make life work, which is a reduction of the gospel to help. And what we've got to recognize is that if people want help in this world, Oprah is a whole lot better than the Sunday sermon in our culture. But here's the other thing. I think most people know this game's going on, but they don't know how to get out of it. The other piece is that all the narratives, all the stories, all the experiences that are going on out there in the culture, the big bad world, are going on right inside that church and those people. It's that these narratives never have a chance to be given voice. Now, if I had the time, I'd want to do a whole theological conversation about what happens when people don't have the capacity to give language to what they're experiencing, which I think goes on in most churches. So again, to put it briefly, you have to create an environment in which the real narratives that are going on in people's lives are given voice and are brought into conversation with the biblical text. Hmm. But the biblical text isn't used as an instrument to convince people to do something. It's an invitation for people to enter in and be read by this strange text in the midst of their real stories. When that starts to happen, and you begin to enter those narratives of people, this is not a top-down process. The Spirit of God's amongst those people. Hmm. And imagination starts to break out. So that what you're actually doing is saying, these people in this church can begin, if you create the environment, to imagine how they might be God's people in these communities. Now, I think that requires the conversion of the church. Here's my hunch. My hunch is that we've created a church in which most folk inside, as I said earlier, are constantly looking to the program and the great leader. And what that's telling us is that we have acculturated churches to believe that inside them there are no answers. They got to go looking for them. Whereas, if I read the New Testament, the very opposite is the case. Amongst these ordinary people are all the answers to the question, how do we become God's people in this community? Now, having said that, you know, it's not a magic wand. There are processes. There are skills that leaders need to be able to do this. There are theological imaginations that need to be engaged. So I'm not trying to pretend that this is a naive, simple kind of thing. It's not. It's difficult. It's hard work. And it's a long journey. But that's how I would go about it.
You are listening to an Alelon Netcast, the Roxbury Journal, Episode 3. Sarah Jane R. Walker with a quote from Al's latest book from Alelon Publishing.
The Sky is Falling, Leaders Lost in Transition by Alan Roxborough. Uncertainty is the tenor of the times. It permeates our work, our families, and the very nature of our relationships with one another. Furthermore, over the past decade or so, there has been a massive erosion of confidence in the major institutions that gave 20th century North America its sense of stability and permanence. People's confidence in government, medicine, education, law, business, and religion as sources of trust, truth, and honesty is very low. The pillars upon which we built our social systems are now deeply suspect. In the place of confidence has emerged a broad, chronic sense of uncertainty. At all levels and across a spectrum of roles, leaders find themselves in a strange, new, precarious location. Liminals feel this uncertainty is loss. Increasing numbers of them are turning to homeschooling, gated communities, or traditional values in efforts to fend off the uncertainty and deal with a world that feels increasingly scary. They seem to want to retreat, build walls, and defend at all costs. At the same time, many emergents deal with the uncertainty and alienation by deconstructing our foundational institutions, including the church, hoping they can construct something more relevant to life around them from the rubble. They distance themselves from the immediate past, viewing it as unworthy of their trust. For them, it is not about where we have been, but where we might go. Their battle cry is to advance, deconstruct whatever might get in their way in the process, and hopefully discover a land of new promise just over the next horizon.
You're listening to an Alelon Netcast, the Roxbury Journal.
Seems that this is would involve a totally different type of pastoral leadership than has been taught to a lot of us in the modern mindset.
Yeah.
So we've been prepared. I think a lot of people have said we've been prepared for a world that no longer exists.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What sort of shifts have to take place in the way that pastors go about pastoring a congregation?
Sure. My first answer might surprise you. The first is a theological shift. And I'll tell you why. I can move on to all kinds of practical things. I spend my life doing this. And I know that vague ideas don't change anything, but theology is not vague ideas. There has to be a deep theological shift in imagination. I would say, as you've stated it, that particularly for evangelicals, that in the 20th century, the shaping and training of pastors was really around learning the right propositions and doctrines and aligning people up around that. But secondly, there was a deep pragmatic conviction that in the leader, the well-trained leader, was the person who had the answers. And so it's very anxiety-producing for pastors to hear that, in fact, the kind of strategic planning, the mission and vision statements that they create, that these things, in fact, are the very opposite of how you go about cultivating imagination and missional creativity in churches. Having said that, what I'm describing requires inviting a community of people on a journey. And it's a journey that's not going to take 18 months. It's a long-term journey. It's what Eugene Peterson so beautifully entitled in his book on the Psalms, a long journey in the same direction. So part of what it means is that the pastor becomes a local theologian, an interpreter. The second thing, which I write about, is the pastor becomes a poet. And what I mean by that is that I've been a pastor myself, we've been trained often in kind of counseling, pastoral counseling techniques, which, as good as they are at the end of the day how to fix people and help them be, quote, healthy in the culture. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not against that. It's not what I'm talking about. The role of the poet is, to use the language of the theater, is to listen to the narratives beneath the narratives, or in stage plays, to listen to what's called the voice-offs. And what I mean by that is that, for example, in a stage play, there's a script, and people are living by these scripts, and the script is real, and it's there, but at the same time, there are these what's called voice-offs, these other voices going on. And so the role of the pastor is to listen deeply to the narratives and stories that are going on in the lives of their peoples. And that requires time. And so part of it is for a pastor to say, these are my people, I'm here and I'm not going anywhere. We need a good dose of Benedictine practices. And remember, the Benedictines, when you sign on, you stay put. And so none of what I'm talking about can happen if pastors are thinking about, you know, 3 or 4 years here, 3 or 4 years there. This is long-term life. It is pitching your tent beside. Then, to take people on a journey, you need to do well the things they expect of you. Leadership is competency in the areas of operation and functionality. So to bring about what I call missional change in a church, a leader needs to be good at those things that people expect. So preaching. People expect on a Sunday or whatever it is, preaching. You better be good at that. You need to work at it, and you need so that people have a confidence in that. Visitation, caring for people, all those standard classical pastoral roles are not to be jettisoned and thrown out. I find it fascinating that numbers of my friends in the U.S. are now leading large emergent churches. These are the things that they're discovering. We can't throw these out. These are classic critical skills. So I don't want to diminish those. And what those things do is build a platform of trust. And remember, nobody's going to follow you if they don't trust you. And trust is, in the things that we expect, he or she does well. Having done that, you know that doing those things well, as important as they are never going to innovate missional life in a church. So what you're doing is a whole pile of other things. And I have to talk about what you don't do. What we're trained to do, for example, is programmatically think about, and I just mentioned this, the minister goes in or the pastor goes in and says, you know, we're going to create a vision statement, we're going to create a mission statement, we're going to align our resources, God's given us a vision to be. You have to lose that imagination, that kind of top-down imagination. And what you begin to do is you begin to create conversations in the church. Now, at some levels, this is going to sound really fuzzy and willy-nilly, but it's very intentional. How I would go about doing that is you create experiments. And you might create experiments in bringing a group of people together to learn some very simple practices of Christian life. What would those practices of Christian life be? For example, how do you welcome the stranger? What does it look like to practice hospitality to the other? Let's begin to practice this. Or how do we learn, and you have to use different language in the evangelical church, but I would say, how do you learn the daily office? Basic spiritual practices. So it's about how do you create spaces where people are learning these things. And what you're doing is you are inviting people to really get at a number of things. One, you invite them into the rhythm of God's life and God's time. That's what the practices are like. You invite them to begin reflecting upon and giving language to the things that are actually happening to them. Because most of the folk in our churches are driven as much by the insecurities, the anxieties, the confusions of the culture as anybody else outside. So how do you get at those? Not to fix them, but to begin to say, what are we hearing here? What is this saying about who we are? And how do we invite Scripture to read us? Not judgmentally. So that's the space you're creating. What that space does is that it invites people after a while to begin to say, now why are we the way we are? Why are we this kind of church, not that kind of church? And when those questions start to arise, you don't then come up with a plan to change your church. You begin to say, well, are there a few experiments we can try? And you invite people into these experiments because you see, to use different language, whole systems change just creates whole systems resistance or problems, and people don't know how to deal with it. So you keep innovating experiments. And what you do with those experiments is you say, ah, look at this, see what's happening. And the reason the experiment language is so important is that it creates an environment in the church where people are given permission to fail. Now, you know and I know that most people, when they walk inside a church, understand implicitly that failure is not permitted. We might preach grace, we might say all those things, but underneath, it's a deeply performative environment. So we've got to create an environment where it's okay to fail, because that's the only context where experiments can thrive, and it's the only context in which we can learn and reflect. I'm not talking about a linear process. I'm talking about a deeply iterative process whereby you are the poet listening to these narratives. You are inviting people into conversation with Scripture. You are inviting people to welcome the stranger to your table and listen to their conversations. All of this is all going on. So now that's a very different set of skills than the one I was trained in, or I suspect you were trained in, at seminary. So we got to learn a whole new set of stuff, which raises a new kind of question. Because you see, for a pastor, you can go to a conference and you can learn a program and you can bring it and start doing it. But if you're talking about a process of culture change, guess what? We don't know how to do it. So we've got to learn this. And that takes a lot of humility, because it's about saying, I know how to preach well, I know how to care well, I know how to do certain disciple things, but I don't know how to innovate culture change. So we got to learn this together. And that's a whole other language. And I think the difficulty of that for most pastors is that they find themselves still in this solo pastoral role. It's just me. I don't think you can go on this journey on your own. You can only go on this kind of journey in collegiality and partnership with your people and other pastors, because we're all in this new learning place.
You've talked about abbots and the whole role. It's unfamiliar language for a lot of evangelicals.
Right.
So
yeah,
I think it's sort of along the lines of that collegiality and,
yeah,
and somebody, I guess, doing the same thing with the pastors, right?
Right, that's right, exactly right, yeah. Yeah.
So unpack that a little
bit.
Well,
sure. Again, one of the deep myths of modernity, of course, is the individual. And the imagination, it's very interesting when you ask people about leadership, just to sit and listen to the names that start to pop up. And we could all give these names. And what this is telling us is that our images of leadership are these great leaders, particular kinds of individuals. And so we have an imagination of leadership birthed in modernity about the individual. And it's almost like a kind of a Nietzschean Uberman, an Ayn Randian kind of character. I know as evangelists we hate those people, but that's our views of leadership very often. Well, if it's not that, we shift it to sort of the therapist, the pastoral care kind of person. But it's individualized, you see. And that's just so deeply embedded in us in modernity. What I'm describing gets behind modernity, and I'm not suggesting we can go back, but the recognition that we are a deeply embedded social community. And this is part of the postmodern turn, in the sense that we aren't, in the modern sense, individuals. We are shaped and interactive with one another. I am who I am, not because I've made myself. I am who I am because of the families and the social relationships that I've been in and that have come before me. And so the innovation of a new life is always a communal, sociocultural set of interactions. And when I use the language of Abbott, I'm trying to get at, I think, a difficult calling, but one that's necessary, an invitation to step out of this individualized understanding of leadership. Because in the complexities of the world in which we live, very, very few people can be all the things that are expected mm-hmm. and shouldn't be. It's just a lousy model. Mm-hmm. So what the abbot did, the abbot or abbess, was always the one who, by agreement, formed a rule of life. And what was very interesting in the early monastic orders was they lived by a simple rule of life, particularly in the Celtic groups. And the rule of life might be, as in the, well, take the Benedictines, to pray and welcome the stranger. The abbot's role was to ask, now how as a community do we create the environment for that to take place? And it wasn't that you create then a set of laws, here's what you must do, but the abbot invites the community into conversations, one-on-one or two-on-one, asking, if this is our rule of life, how do we live this rule of life? What are the ways of doing that? And then meeting with people and saying, how are you doing with the rule of life? Where are you going with that? But none of that was coercive, but it was the creation of a very different kind of community. So the abbot was not simply a brilliant preacher who stood up on Sunday and then kind of linked it out to a whole bunch of feeder stations out there that people came to because they loved this great leader. I mean, that's individualism gone mad. The abbot was in and among his or her people, and their role was to cultivate environment so that this community witnessed to kingdom life. So that's what I'm getting at. The other piece I'm saying there is that if we are serious in cities like Toronto or Vancouver or Calgary or Winnipeg, it doesn't matter, about being God's witnessing people, then we have to find ways, as I'm now talking about pastors and leaders, of really confessing our individualism, confessing the divisiveness of our own churches, that is, this is my church, that's your church, and rediscover Paul's understanding that there is a church in the city. It may be made up of multiple places. And the abbot's role, this is the great opportunity that executive ministers of denominations could discover, is to ask, how do we gather and form ourselves as a collegium for the sake of the city? Now, to do that, that's not primarily about, let's create a plan. It's not about that. It's, what's the rule of life? And how do we live into that rule of life? And in that rule of life, how do we then become responsible for one another and our particular communities? I think that's the only way in which we're going to create the imaginations to be God's witnessing people. And I think the great tragedy is that whether you are an established church or a lot of emergent churches, we still remain pretty isolated doing our own thing. That's modernity. For me, that's the abbot's role.
Okay. One more question.
Yeah, that's fine.
There is this pull towards Egypt again, so using the illustration you did before.
Oh, right.
The onions and leeks that were back there.
Yeah.
And I think probably for a lot of clergy, too, there's a sense of, you know what, it was really nice. We've got a guy who planted a church in the Hal McBain in the fellowship.
I remember Hal McBain.
He lives next door here.
No kidding.
His residence.
He was a saint.
Oh, yeah. He still is, but
he was a deep saint.
You know, he did fabulous things, but
that was then.
That was then, and there's a sense of, you know, those were nobody then. It was easier to navigate church leadership.
Absolutely.
So there's this pull, like, oh man, if I just found a church where I could preach and visit and stuff.
It would all come back together again.
Or there's a sense within churches, too, that, oh, if only, you know, when we ran Awana and did this, you know.
Exactly right, yeah.
Nostalgia for the past. How do you deal with that gravitational pull back in the past?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you a story, if this will help. And because for me, it was transformative. When I, in the early 1980s, and believe me, I was in my early 30s, I suppose, and I thought I was God's gift to the church. I was arrogant, and you can print that, I don't care. I remember going into this church of 30 senior citizens, and my whole attitude to them was, you know, you poor people, aren't you lucky that you've got me? And I remember that as the church grew, these older people, they'd constantly come to me, and they'd say, if only we could, or they'd remind me of the great days of Dr. So-and-so when, you know, the church was full and there were three choirs and two Sunday schools and, you know, all of this. And they were referring back to the heydays of the 50s and 60s kind of thing, or 40s, 50s and 60s, right after the war. And it just got up my nose. And I just wanted to say, you know, go take a hike. And that was just, I'm not saying that was good, I'm confessing that. So one day, I'm sitting with Nell, and Nell is now in her 80s. And by chance, I said to Nell, "Nell, when did you move to this community?" And she says, "Well," she said, "we moved with our mom and dad," and she's now talking about the turn of the century, like early 1900s. And the Danforth, now we're talking about a mile from Young Street, last three quarters of a mile, the Danforth, she said, was just a mud road and wooden sidewalks, and she said the Don Valley was just nothing, and over the other side of the Don Valley was just open field. She's describing this to me, and I'm listening. Then she began to say, on the other side of the Don Valley there were these squatters and market gardeners, and she says my mum and my dad, they were deacons in a church, you know, might have been Java Street. We're now living in this new area around the Danforth. And they looked across and they said, we've got to start a Sunday school. And she describes how on Saturdays, they would dress them up in their best Sunday dresses. And they'd get dressed up and they'd walk down this valley, the Don Valley, across a rickety old bridge and up rickety old steps. And they'd go from these tents and these tin huts. And they'd start saying to these people, could we start a Sunday school for your kids? And they said, well, you know what I'm listening to? I am listening to the story of ordinary people who imagine things for God. So what did I learn from that? I learned that in the midst of all of this, wouldn't it be great when? There are all kinds of other stories. And you see, this is the poet's work, is that you can't take that nostalgia away from people, but you listen for the other stories. And they're always there. And these are the other stories of God at work. And you can then begin to imagine things out of that. You know, I could say lots of other things. You don't despise people's nostalgia. In the midst of it, you ask permission to experiment. You don't tell them it's all over, too bad, let's get on with the new. And you don't ram this new missional stuff or emergent stuff down their throats. You love them. And you live amongst them, and you begin to find the people who want to try some experiments. And those experiments become the context for conversations. What are we learning together? What's God saying amongst us? Yeah.
And God seems to bring around the right people just as you need them.
It's always been my experience. Yeah. I know a lot of pastors would say otherwise, but my experience has always been that when you live into those, that kind of imagination, it's amazing the people God brings around.
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal. Yeah, I've never had anything other than that happen.
Yeah. That's great.
Good.
I appreciate that. Thank
you. Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant stuff.
You are listening to an episode of a Leilon Netcast's Roxburgh Journal. Alelon is excited to announce that we will be holding two Summer Institute events this June. Fuller Seminary and Dupree Center will partner with us in a dynamic learning experience titled Practicing Missional Leadership, Bridging Great Ideas with the Messy Realities of Leadership. This institute will be held June 11 to 13 in Pasadena, California, and registration is limited. Our second institute will be with Carey Theological College and the Missional Training Network in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. The Vancouver event is titled Forming Missional Leaders in a Changing Context and will be held June 18 to 20. Please visit alelon.org for more information or to register.
The Roxburgh Journal is an Alelon netcast. Executive producer, Mark Priddy. Written and produced by Alan Roxburgh. Line producer, Sarah Jane Walker. Edited and mixed by Bill Kinnon. Original music, Substance Over Style. Webmaster, Brian Martini. Thanks for listening.